Prologue. Sammy's Bench, 51.59269 degrees north, 0.12825 degrees west. When I saw the bench for the first time, I thought, Rohana really is doing grief better than me. It's a simple bench. The view from it seems to radiate outwards like the layers of a conker. At the centre, there's this gorgeous burned chocolate seat encased by Alexandra Park. Then beyond, there's the B106 and Hornsey train tracks, and further still, you can see Canary Wharf, the Gherkin, the Shard, and, on a very clear day, the London Eye. That day, the silver birches glowed white hot, and a Turkish hazel dangled its mustardy catkins. Cherry trees were flowering too, their petals like pink candy floss across the park. Ali Pali seemed the first place to offer spring's promise. Maybe it had been happening for a while, I just hadn't been looking. I even saw a nuthatch, its steely grey head working its way down a tree trunk. I would have said it was a sign, if I believed in that kind of thing. Everyone arrived with food and alcohol and daffodils. One of the boys began laying the flowers out in an S beside the bench, but before he could finish, a passing Boston Terrier tore through the display. The dog shook his daffodil-stuffed muzzle until the petals were shredded like yellow confetti. Cradling the dog, the owner apologised profusely and walked away backwards. Another stranger stopped to ask, "What are you doing?" Rohana replied, "It's my sister Sammy's birthday. She would have been 23. The stranger nodded, then walked on. I wondered if he'd think about it later. Maybe he'd even call his sister, just to say hi. Probably not. Even I didn't do that, and I should really know better. I stood on my own for a while and looked at the plaque. How lucky we are to have something that makes saying goodbye so hard. Bloody hell, that's good, I thought. Tragic yet profound. The combination of a Winnie the Pooh quote and a monotype course of a font was nostalgic and moving. Without being pretentious or mystical, it was perfect. People were passing around a big bag of lightly sea-salted Tyrrells and plastic cups of Carver. I took two glasses. It was a trick someone at work taught me once. Take two, and then, if you're done with the conversation, you can nod towards the drinks and pretend you're delivering one to a friend. This wasn't so subtle in a park. I just looked like an alcoholic. I tried to get out of a conversation with Sammy's trampoline instructor, but there was nowhere to hide, so walking away meant striking up a conversation with someone new and offering them the other cup. The woman who accepted it was wearing a pair of cotton dungarees and tiny koi carp earrings that swished like they were swimming when she talked. She said she'd recently moved to a canal boat near Little Venice so she could get some peace and quiet to finish her screenplay. Unfortunately, she said, it's not quiet. Living on the river means constantly hearing the same two things. People walking past saying the name of your boat aloud, oh, Darjeeling, and couples breaking up. Rohana was busy being hugged by people. I got jealous again watching all the embraces. She was the piece de resistance at this death party and wore it well. Her smile put other people at ease. She was wearing grey trousers and this black turtleneck. I wondered if she'd planned that. Looking down at my own denim coat and green slacks, I berated myself for dressing so colourfully at a memorial. I considered how many cups of Carver it would take for me to ask a stranger for a hug. Probably only three. Then again, I knew three would make me angry before they'd make me affectionate. As if I'd manifested him, a man appeared beside me with the bottle and a stack of cups. He had a squash packet of menthols in his breast pocket and a ginger moustache which needed a trim, as the hairs were curling over his upper lip. Since he had both hands full, he peeled a cup from the others with his teeth and nudged it towards me. On a different day, I might have put it back and taken one that hadn't touched his mouth. He did an elegant pour that was all foam, so I chased the bottle when he tried to pull away to let him fill it up once the bubbles died down. We stood in silence for a while. Then he asked me how I knew Sammy. I know Rohana, her sister. We met at a bereavement retreat. How about you? I asked. Cello lessons, he replied. That she was exceptionally musically talented was one of the things I knew about Sammy from what Rohana had told me. I also knew her favourite meal was macaroni cheese. She was the life and soul of any party, and she played piano too. Beautifully, apparently. Sammy died while travelling in South America. It was an allergic reaction. She wasn't alone when it happened. There were people sitting outside on plastic chairs playing cards. When organising her things, Rohana and her mum discovered her vibrators and had a good laugh about it. I held an image of Sammy in my mind, but couldn't remember if Rohana had shown it to me in a frame or on her phone or from a small print folded up in her wallet. I thought about Sammy's face so often that it was as clear in my mind as if it were a memory. A bereavement retreat. He said the words back as if wanting to hear how they sounded coming from his mouth. So strange. I've never heard of that before. What was it like? Someone took a cup from his stack. Whatever you're imagining, probably that. I looked around. There were maybe 30 to 40 people there. I'd endured small talk with three. I could probably leave soon. And everyone's... This guy wasn't fast. Bereaved, yes, I confirmed. We were quiet again. He sipped and some of the bubbles lingered on the hair above his lip. I'm not sure why, but I felt the need to add, I met a girl whose brother had choked on a sausage at the dinner table and died in front of his whole family. He swallowed. Death by bangers and mash, can you imagine? He said, clearly imagining it. And what happened to you? I could have replied that my brother died from a rare bone cancer 4 years ago, but the thought of saying his name made me feel sick, so I decided to put my sunglasses on instead. It was rude, but the sheer effort it took to be stood up, existing in that moment while holding a plastic cup in my hand felt monumental. I wished he'd leave me alone. Eventually, I caught Rohana's eye and gave her a look that I hope said, "What an awful fucking day." "How have you been?" She downed her cup and extended her hand to allow someone to refill it. "Fine," I lied. Rohana's eye twitched and I could tell she didn't believe me, but wasn't sure she could take on asking for the truth. We were both doing our best. She let out a low sigh. Every year, I tell myself it's just like any other day, and just like any other day, it will pass and be okay. But it's not. It's just shit. I took her hand and agreed. Unbelievably shit. Somehow, Sammy's birthday did the same to me. It punctured my calendar like a storm in an otherwise cloudless sky. For weeks, I'd watched it loom on the horizon, reminding me of this thing I was trying to forget. Then, that morning, I woke up with exceptional clarity and told my boyfriend I wanted to break up and would be moving out. It was both entirely related and had nothing to do with Sammy's birthday. I had hoped that things to do with living, boyfriend, flat, job, drinking, friends, would make me feel better. Sammy's anniversary reminded me that I needed to be better at the things to do with dying. I hugged Rohana goodbye and left the party. Then I left the park, and then London. I wasn't sure how long it would be before I'd return. My mum had agreed to drive from Wales to pick me up. If she could have, she would have said, "I told you so," but I don't think she'd seen this one coming. Anyway, that doesn't matter. What matters is that she came to get me. She pulled up in a Honda that still had the mud spray of the Breckens on the wheel rims. It was a miracle we'd found each other while I was walking the streets around Ali Pali, because I'd long given up trying to explain live location to her. "Get in," she said. "You know how much I hate the North Circular." Spring. Chapter 1. Amnoir. 51.85996 degrees north, 3.13642 degrees west. For a long time, being in my family has felt like living in a waiting room. We were seven for many years, before my older brothers moved out and we became five. Then Tom died and we returned from the hospital as a four for the very first time. I had hoped that moving out would mean moving forward. Emma did too, so we both left. Two. Then I started the sequence in reverse and moved back home with my parents. Three. Though I knew we would never reach seven again. Being part of a family as large as ours meant fighting to be seen, heard, and fit in a five-seater Honda Civic. We are therefore a chaotic unit of loud voices and colourful personalities. My parents are the outdoors type. They have a National Trust membership and listen to a lot of Radio 4. Dad is a smoker, Marlboro's outdoors, vaping indoors. And my mum looks like she's recently quit, though she's never had a cigarette in her life. Lawrence and Howard are a decade older than me and were the best and worst babysitters. Once they said that if I told our parents about their party, they'd tie me to a picnic bench and cover me in strawberry jam so bees would eat me alive. They're my half-brothers from Dad's first marriage, but I never considered them anything less than fully mine. Then there's me, Although I'm technically the middle child, I have all the qualities, confident, conscientious, and bossy, of being eldest, as Lawrence and Howard left for university during my pre-adolescence, and I took on the role of telling my younger siblings what to do. They're the twins, Emma and Tom. Except, Tom is missing, of course, so uniting as a family always feels like we can't quite start the party. There's still one guest to arrive, and we're all hoping he'll walk through the door again one day. After Tom's death, Mum and Dad moved away from the house where we had spent our childhood, which felt like a complicated relief. I'd thought that being somewhere new would stop it feeling haunted, but Tom's things and pictures were still there. Sometimes it was nice to be haunted. I welcomed his ghost and got frustrated that I didn't believe in that kind of thing more, that I didn't have the faith. Their home is a long, low house, half in the clouds in the Breckens. Nearby, there's the Sugarloaf Mountain, a mining tourist attraction called Big Pit, and a ring road that leads to a large Waitrose. The house is called Amnar, meaning for now in Welsh. My parents always speak about it like it's an in-between place, yet they've been there for a few years. Jobs need doing, but stay on the list. The storms rattling over the River Usk tug the windows away from the sills, and there are nails left in the walls from hanging photographs of a family we never met, the wallpaper a different colour around the frame's shadowy outline. Amnar. After Tom, everything felt temporary. Everything felt transient. 6 weeks after Sammy's anniversary, I was still in Wales. I was beginning to tire of circling around my parents and their everydayness. The way Dad left tea bags in the sink and Mum left every cupboard and drawer open. I floated from my laptop to making tea, to staring out the window and then to bed where I searched lesbian oil massage on Pornhub, then fell asleep to Stephen Fry narrated audiobooks. I wondered when I should return to London. Rohana texted to ask how I was. I labelled it unread in the hope that I might have the strength to reply later. My younger sister, Emma, phoned too and said she'd come visit at the weekend. She lives in Solihull with her Staffordshire boyfriend, Dan, who likes to post about carp fishing on Instagram. They met when she tapped him on the shoulder in a chicken shop and said, "I like your accent." They travel around the country watching darts tournaments. She does her food shopping on a Sunday and has a meal plan for the week ahead, including packed lunches that she takes to the office. She knows how to use grout cleaner and regularly drives to my grandma just to check in. She has her life together in a way I fear I never will. Since I'd left London, she'd been messaging me things like, "Are you eating?" and "How is it being alone in Wales?" In my replies, I usually compensated for my lack of vulnerability with exclamation marks and bake-off gifts. I texted back to say I was leaving Wales that weekend, which wasn't true because I couldn't handle the thought of her big brown eyes worrying at me. My commute to work was the 20 seconds it took me to walk from my bedroom to Mum's desk. There was a mug of tea waiting for me beside the keyboard. I could tell it had been there for a while from the brown tannine film on the surface. I'd overslept again. Grief was a hole I walked around during the day and fell into at night. I looked out the window and saw Mum loading boxes and a broken toaster into the car. Guessing from her muddy leggings, bum bag and anorak, she was going horse riding after the dump. Going to the dump is one of my parents' favourite pastimes. I wondered if that was something to do with their age or unique to the type of people they are. She waved, and I waved back, with the study window a passive spectator between us. Mum tipped her hand towards her mouth to gesture drinking tea. Giving a thumbs up, I mimed, "Yep, got it, thanks." Took a sip, then realised it was cold and dribbled it back into the mug. I'd microwave it later. Mum slammed the boot shut and drove away. Last week, I'd had to explain to a colleague that boot means trunk while localising a country album review from American to British English. "Boot like shoe?" she'd asked, and I'd said, "Yes, but also no," which felt like an explanation I gave a lot at work. My job was writing album reviews and artist biographies. It involved spending an inordinate amount of time on thesaurus.com. I could do it from Wales. In fact, I could do it anywhere. There was Wi-Fi, Wikipedia, and enough time for me to sit and have an extended period of self-loathing where I contemplated deleting everything I'd written before realising I was too close to deadline. My therapist said I worked so hard in an attempt to impress my parents. She often said things like this, and I wondered if in therapy there should be an ache of resonance in my belly when she talked. Instead, I felt she'd deeply misunderstood me. Perhaps it was less active than misunderstanding, simply not seeing or looking in the wrong direction. It was clear, to me at least, that I worked so hard to avoid thinking about Tom. I was mostly successful in my attempts. I opened my laptop. 2 unread emails. The subject line of the first read, "Thank you, team, XOXO. I knew then it would be from Annie, as she's the only colleague I have who would actually write XOXO. Many of my Monday mornings have been spent watching her choose a quote of the week for her email signature from hellogiggles.com. Annie's dog, Rocco, had died, and she was writing to thank us for the flowers. Attached to the email was a poorly composed photo of the bouquet beside a framed print of the dog's paws. I wondered if Annie had had that made after the dog was dead, and if the vet had put its paw in a special kind of ink to make it. She wrote, "Only time will heal my broken heart," and she was sad to miss the planning review, but still coming to terms with my new reality. The second email was a follow-up from a different colleague asking me to contribute to the flowers and explaining that Annie would be off till the 13th. I looked at my calendar. A week? I tried to calm down by reminding myself that it was a very big Icelandic sheepdog, and its absence must be noticeable in the house. Then I remembered that Annie was grieving for an animal that regularly ate its own sick. I was so livid that I walked into the bathroom, stuffed my mouth with a half-finished loo roll, and screamed as loud as I dared. It wasn't uncommon for me to be angry when I felt misunderstood, and it wasn't uncommon for me to be misunderstood when talking about grief, so I suppose for a few years I'd been quite an angry person. Nothing triggered me more than hearing people talk about their pets' deaths. Dead grandparents usually set me off, but I could muster some sympathy for a human loss. Cats or dogs, however, I could not tolerate. Losing her dog was incomparable to the loss I had suffered, and yet I couldn't stop myself comparing. I kept thinking about the memorial paw print. If I could have a cast of Tom's handprint on my desk, I would. I felt rage, but mostly jealousy. I was jealous that she'd felt able to ask for the time and space she needed. I was jealous that she'd had all these words to articulate how she felt. I was jealous that people acknowledged her grief. I was jealous that she had asked for help and that people had helped her. I was jealous because what Annie showed me was that I'd wasted time I could have been loved and cared for, being alone and misunderstood instead. My phone pinged. "It'll be a long week with Annie off. Post-work pint at the Blue Post tonight?" Not everyone had realised I wasn't in London. This wasn't surprising. People aren't always good noticers. When Tom died, I'd gone back to work very quickly. I hadn't stopped since. I was worried what would happen if I did. I learned a lot when I returned. At first, I said I was not well when people asked how I was. Not well at all. Then I found myself either apologising for upsetting them or rejected when they gave a reply that only lasted the time it took from pressing the coffee machine to an Americano appearing in their mug. "I suppose everything happens for a reason," one said, and retreated to their desk. "Oh, Freya, it's a good job you're so brave," another commented. "Must go, this pitch won't write itself, eh?" The one I really couldn't handle was, "He's in a better place now." I learned to say, "I'm well, thank you," and watched a lot of reality TV for somewhere to go from there. That made everyone feel fine. Nobody spoke to me about Tom, but they all carried on emailing. They signed off, "best wishes," and I started my replies, "hello, hope you're well." For a while, I hoped nothing for no one. Then I thought that hoping was the only thing that would save me. From there, I leaned into the positivity movement. I carried on contributing to a corporate culture insistent on smiling, as if capitalism was what would save me. My office hours, then happy hours, became the medium with which I was yoked to reality. I spent my time safely losing it in predictable ways. There was something familiar and cozy about working too hard, drinking too much, and having sex too often. Sometimes I needed to feel another person's weight to feel my own. Sometimes I needed to swim to feel weightless. It was good to go between feeling my body was everything and nothing. I learned to unbuckle myself like that. I replied to the text, "out of town, sorry," then leaned back into Mum's office chair and spun around. Her desk is cluttered with trinkets, photos, a roll of sticky tape, and a dish full of feathers. When Tom died, Mum started collecting them whenever she went for a walk. She likes the white ones best. I suppose because they look like angels sent them from the heavens. I've resisted telling her they're probably pigeon feathers. Rubbing one between my fingers, I thought about Sammy's bench and wished I had a place to feel Tom. I typed a message to Emma, pictures of Tom everywhere in this house, then saw how it looked with the heart eyes emoji, crying emoji, or face with steam from nose emoji. Typing Tom's name was the only place I saw him in the present these days. Seeing it made me feel as empty as a scorched out crater. I backspaced the message and the cursor blinked at me. I wondered if Tom would recognize the person I'd become after his death. Probably not. There was the duty I had to him to be the person he knew, then the duty I had to myself to be whoever I needed to be to keep going. Someday soon, there'd be time for both. For now, it was, hello, hope you're well, and best wishes, Freya.